Okay, we'll get started. So, welcome to the August 2024 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly session is designed for current DMSC students and faculty, and frankly, anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences at A.T. Still University. And we're always thrilled to have inspiring guest speakers who have made a significant impact in the PA profession and the healthcare field. Before we begin, a couple of reminders. Please keep your microphones muted and feel free to share any comments or questions in the chat section during the presentation. We'll have a Q&A session at the end where you can unmute yourself. Dr. Beth Popre, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any questions or comments. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, but today we have the pleasure of introducing our guest, Ann Davis, MS, PAC, who has had an illustrious career in the PA profession spanning over 46 years as a clinician, an educator, and a PA advocate. Ann retired in February 2019 after more than two decades with the American Academy of Physician Assistants, where she made significant contributions to the PA profession through legislative and advocacy initiatives. Ann received both her Bachelor's of Science and Master of Science degrees from the Child Health Associate Program at the University of Colorado and has been a certified PA since 1978. Ann's experience with children has made her a pioneer in providing care to the underserved in her early years as a PA. As the first PA in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is really when I first met Ann, she practiced with Flagstaff Pediatrics, coordinating the county's Well Child program and providing care for the students at the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs Student Dormitory. Prior to joining the AAPA in 1994, Ann also practiced as a PA in Grass Valley, California, at the Sacramento Children's Medical Clinic, and worked as a PA instructor at the Child Health Associate Program in the Department of Pediatrics, University of Colorado Health Sciences. Throughout her career, Ann was a pioneer in providing care to underserved populations, particularly children, as I mentioned a minute ago. She played a key role in advancing the PA profession by working on legislative efforts to improve state laws and expand the scope of practice for PAs. Ann's dedication and leadership have earned her numerous honors and awards, recognizing her outstanding contribution to the field. So we're really honored to have Ann join us today to share her experiences and insights with our masterclass participants. Ann, welcome to the masterclass.
Thanks so much, Randy.
Well, Ann, we could spend a lot of time just talking about some fun times you and I had in Arizona, driving back between, Phoenix and Sedona every year for leadership of ASAPA. But let's start off with hearing about some of your earlier experiences in the PA profession, particularly your entry into the Child Health Associate Program. What got you interested in being a PA, and then your clinical work in Arizona? Could you share some of those highlights with us?
Sure. So I grew up in Nebraska and thought that when I went to college, I should go far, far away. So I decided to go to Colorado, and my family didn't have two nickels to rub together. So I went to community college and I was lucky to find a really great one, which was really just over the border. It was in Colorado, really in name only. It was just over the border from Nebraska. And there there were a lot of cowboys and very good, solid science education because a lot of people went into veterinary medicine. So I happened to be sitting next to a cowboy in a biology class, and he had a brochure that said, be a child health associate. And I thought, well, I have never heard of that. Let me see. And sure enough, he showed me the brochure, and it was about the child associate program, which was pediatric PA program at the University of Colorado. So I thought, someone had designed this career exactly for me. I had no family who'd gone to medical school, no doctors in my kindred. So I didn't really have any role models that way. And I didn't think I could afford to go to school as long as it would take to become a physician. So I thought that the PA program sounded exactly right for me. So I applied after 2 years of community college and 1 year living in Colorado to get residency so I could afford tuition. And sure enough, they took me. And then I went on to the University of Colorado PA program. And Dr. Silver was the program director at that time. And it was a perfect fit for me. I wanted to do pediatric as a member of a healthcare team, and it couldn't have been better. It was an ideal place for me to land.
Oh, that's great. Oh, by the way, welcome, Dr. Bill Kohab, joining us today to say hi to Anne. That's great to have you here. Thank you. Anne, talk a little bit about your movement over to Flagstaff Pediatrics and some of the early years as being a PA. You remember back in those days, I mean, nobody could spell PA, and all of a sudden we're there, taking, in your case, taking care of pediatric patients, and at the same time getting involved in the Arizona State Association. Talk a little bit about those early days.
It was a wonderful education for me. I worked with three pediatricians, and if you know your geography at that point, and probably still, I'll wager, Flagstaff had the only pediatric group between pretty much Phoenix and Salt Lake, and probably Bakersfield and Albuquerque. So we saw everything. Everything that came in the door was what we were going to take care of, and that meant a lot of a lot of stuff that was very difficult to deal with. We rarely had specialty care. We had an ENT sometimes, almost always had an orthopedist and general surgeons, but we certainly didn't have, neurologists, certainly no pediatric neurologist. So I can remember walking in to see a baby and at the same time kind of looking at the color of the baby and the color of the sky, because if the baby was gray and the sky looked like trouble, we were gonna have a problem. Chopper wouldn't be able to get in, and that was the way we worked. And I was on call there every fourth night and every fourth weekend for 7 years, and it was really a wonderful way to learn pediatrics and learn what would be effective working with families. And because it was a small town with a large area, we saw everybody from the folks that are they're working in the fields to the president of the university's children. And it was a really great education. Also, it was a good cultural education. You're on the border of the what's called the Big Reservation for the Navajo Nation. And then the Hopi Tribes Reservation was close by there too. And then, as you mentioned, there was a place where high school students who lived in towns too small to have a high school could come into Flagstaff, voluntarily live in a dormitory. This isn't the Indian dorms where kids were taken away from their families. These were high school students who wanted to come to Flag for high school. And so I did sit call for high school students 5 days a week there. And those were all Native American students and learned a lot from them about their culture. And then also was in charge of the well-child program for the entire county. So went to Page and all over the county seeing well children, which was also a wonderful thing to do with great backup from the pediatricians that I worked with. One of the most interesting things that happened there is that there was a young woman named Lily who had had a congenital hip that she was Navajo and had not been treated when she was a baby. And her parents thought that she had the congenital hip because her father had shot a deer in the hip when her mother was pregnant with Lily. She had to have a lot of surgery, and so I knew her pretty well because I would see her, when she'd come in for something at sick call at the dorm and help her set up her follow-up care. And when she was in the hospital at Phoenix Indian, actually having a procedure, and my husband and I went to go visit her in the hospital. And while she was there, she said, "Mrs. Davis, I have a question to ask you." I said, "Sure, anything." She said, "Well, can I live with you next summer? I need to go to summer school in order to not be behind a whole year because of being, out with my hip surgery." He said, "Of course you can." So Lily lived with us for a summer and went to high school and just learned a lot culturally by having her in our home. Every day we still have a blanket that her mother made for us as a thank you gift for having Lily live with us. So it was a great experience, a wonderful first job, and really helped solidify my conviction that being a PA was exactly what I wanted. And I really never looked back. I also got involved, as you well know, in the Arizona State Association of PAs, partly just because things happened on my shift, right? I mean, we needed to change the law, and I happened to be president at one point. And also on the legislative committee. I think you probably appointed me to be on the legislative committee, Randy. So learned just by doing it. And I'll tell you, maybe one of the most important things I learned was that you're just in it always for the long game. That one of the pediatricians that I had worked with had played high school football with the Speaker Pro Tem of the Senate. And you probably remember this very day. I remember down to knowing the shoes I was wearing. But we were working very hard on a bill to authorize prescriptive authority for controlled substances for PAs. And I thought we had it in the bag. I was young and naive and, you know, working with staff from the medical board, but we didn't have a lobbyist. So no one to really kind of, you know, tell me what was really happening. And our bill was up for a hearing in the health committee. And there was a physician's wife who was a member of the health committee. She was a state senator. And as they were getting ready for the vote, she got up and walked out. So she did what's called walked our bill. They had no quorum. They couldn't vote. And our bill was dead. And of course, you know, being wed to science, I thought that you did A and B and C would happen. And, you know, in legislation, you do A and B and X happens for nothing you can, nothing you could have figured out in advance. So I was upset and decided that I would just wait till morning to go home. So in the morning, I went to the Senate floor and I sent a message with the page saying up to the guy who was my boss's old high school buddy, who was the Senator Pro Tem of the Senate, and said, now, you know, really bad news. Yesterday, our bill didn't make it out of committee because they lost a quorum at the last moment. But thank you so much for all your help and support. And I'll give Dr. Segrist your best. And he got up from the where he was sitting at the front of the Senate, walked back to me and said, don't go home yet. And so I didn't. And he reassigned the bill, took it out of the health committee and assigned it to the business and professions committee where the bill did fine. So what I learned from that is that you're always playing the long game. You probably don't know the rules. And it's important to be persistent and to rely on your friends.
Yeah, wow. That brings back a lot of memories. You will remember that early on in those days, the PA board, the joint board, really had no PAs. We had two advisory PAs, Chuck Horan and Pat Spangler. Wow, I can't remember. And I know, but I think the point that you make about the long game is, you know, going back every year, developing relationships, and then we ended up getting PAs on the board. And then later on, able to get our own board, like we have today, where we have five PAs and two MDs, two DOs, and two patient advocates. But a great story that I always tell is, you remember Dave Landreth?
Oh yeah.
And Dave, when he was working for the Arizona Medical Association, we went down to testify in front of the Senate Health Committee for a part of our bill that already looked like we had it passed. And so I signed to speak, and a couple of people ahead of me spoke, and I got up to speak, and Dave Landreth grabbed me by my coattail and pulled me down. He says, when you're ahead, shut up. And I learned a lot. So it's the long game and know when to shut up.
Good advice. Good advice. Yeah.
Well, you know, another thing that obviously after you left Arizona and you started getting involved with the Academy, extensive background working with the Academy and really multiple roles there, but really getting to support not only your experience in Arizona, but state legislation throughout the country. Do you have any favorite stories or moments about your experiences with the AAP, both good and bad?
I thought about this a lot, and I think that probably one of my favorite things, even though it was so painful and hard at the time, was working to get legislation passed in Mississippi, which was the last state to license PAs. And as you may recall, the Mississippi Nurses Association there was a complete obstacle for us. And there I learned that you have to really kind of find what I like to call the deal, right? So you can go to state legislators and you can have everything right. That is, you can have all of the right reasons. Things make perfect sense. The logic is on your side. But if you have an adversary who doesn't see it your way, you won't make headway. And that's because you really can't call on state legislators much to choose between their children, right? I mean, this would be like if your children, were fighting over a toy, and you had to decide, you know, which one was going to get that toy. I mean, legislators don't want to be in that position. None of us do. But if you can come up with a solution where everyone is in agreement, then it's very easy for them to love your legislation, right? Because there's no downside for supporting it if everyone, all the stakeholders, can agree. So in Mississippi, it took multiple years, but fortunately, I was able to work with fabulous PAs, and many PAs who would never benefit from this legislation. So, Merle Dotson, who worked for the VA, and even after we got the legislation passed, he never had to get a state license because he was a federal employee. So, John Stevenson and all the PAs who were at the Air Force Base, Keesler, were wonderful. And again, it was selfless work for them because they didn't need a state license. Eventually, what the nurses kept saying is, well, the nurses have to have a master's degree. We're going to have PAs have a master's degree. And we just weren't going to get past that. So we wrote a piece of legislation where everybody who graduated after a certain year, who wasn't already in Mississippi, so we grandparented in everybody currently living there. So if you were in Mississippi on the day the legislation was signed, you didn't have to have a master's degree. You just had to have passed the pants exam and have graduated from accredited program, like it is for every state. But eventually we agreed to that with all these caveats that let people in. And this is at a time where it was relatively available to most PAs to receive a master's degree remotely. So we wrote a bill that said, people coming in later after a certain date will have to have a master's degree to get licensed in Mississippi. And it wasn't our favorite, but it broke them. And, after we had addressed what they said was their issue, was it their issue? I don't know. But they said it was their issue because they thought it was we would never cross that. so they thought it was a good way to keep us out forever. And sure enough, we were able to get the legislation passed. I also learned some things about working with state legislators there. There was a particular state legislator who was the chair of the health committee that was a thorn in our side. We just could not get past him. And it looked like he was, had been delivered with the bricks and was going to be there until the end of time. But I learned from about him that he was a farmer from rural Mississippi and had a child with special needs and could find nothing in the way of resources for his child in his community. So he decided that there ought to be a law that said his kid could get resources in his community. So he ran for state legislature and pursued legislation to allow special needs children to receive resources in their home community. And it was a very important thing. And that wasn't the only good thing he did. So even though I thought he was Satan, that was wrong. He had good motivations for becoming a state legislator and did some very good work, even though loving our bill from the get-go wasn't part of his portfolio, unhappily. Yeah. I think too, working with PAs, legislation doesn't come, working on politics doesn't come easily for PAs. We tend not to like it. We think that if we have all the evidence, right, that people ought to see things our way and come around to believing that we're right about what we are suggesting. This is the way it works in clinical practice. You have all the evidence that says we're going to give you this antibiotic, or you need this procedure, or you need to see this specialist, and people take our word for it. They go do it. This does not happen in state legislatures. So helping PAs become the kind of advocates that they needed to be, certainly they have all the skills, because convincing someone to have a surgical procedure, shouldn't be any harder to convince a state legislator. So PAs have all those advocacy skills. It's just putting them to work in another realm. That's the thing that can be difficult. But it was very interesting and intellectually stimulating to get to work with such a variety of people all of whom wanted to do things for the right reason. You know, we didn't have anybody that said, well, we should do this because I personally will be more wealthy, or I want to do this because it will add to our power, or we need to do this because we want to exert influence over another group, disadvantage someone else. I mean, that was never anybody's motivation. So it was fun because people were very, motivated by the right things. It was easy to advocate for PAs because we had the angels on our shoulders.
Yeah, and you know, you've been involved in so many successes over the years. One thing that comes to my mind is the interaction with the Federation of State Medical Boards early on. You know, you might want to talk a little bit about your experience there. And now, you know, that PAs are an integral part of that. And given what just happened in the last few years, you know, with the licensing, I just lost the term. But the compact, you know, so talk a little bit about, you know, talking to those docs over at the Federation.
Yeah. You know, if you want to find a party crowd, just take every physician who sits on the state medical board and put them in a room together. Right. I mean, that's a good time. I'm joking. they were, such an interesting group to work for. It was such hard duty to work with them. Because I was always the supplicant, you know, I was the one who wanted something from them. I never showed up just, you know, with nothing that I needed. I always wanted something. And at one point, one of my friends who was on my team said, you know, you've got to stop stalking those people from Mississippi. you just got to quit. And so it was all generally older male physicians when we first started, who were members of state medical boards. So people who were used to getting their own way and imposing their way on others, who we had to work with there. And it started from, you know, just attending the meeting, sitting in the back of the room, being very cognizant of what it was that they were interested in, right? You needed to know their topics so that you could relate to them. And then helping them understand things a little bit differently about PAs. I think I went to those meetings for over 30 years, every year, and things changed. Thank goodness. Fortunately, eventually they started electing women and African-American women to be in their leadership. Regina Benjamin, who went on to be one of our surgeons general, was a president of the Federation of State Medical Boards. And of course, when things became more diverse, they became easier for them to accept more diverse opinions and more diverse groups of people. And it also became easier as there were more PAs. So for example, several times during the Federation of State Medical Boards meeting, I would say to someone, a physician on the medical board, well, I'm Ann Davis and I'm a PA. And they would say, oh my goodness, you know, I would trade out my wife before I would trade out my PA. You know, I can't work without my PA. So because all PAs had done such good work, it made my job so much easier because they had an understanding of the PA profession and how integral PAs were to their practice and practice of others. And then they also could understand the issues that we had because they turned out to be issues for them, you know, personally in their own practices. Certainly the number of PAs that a physician, I'm going to use the word supervise because that's what we used back then, physician could supervise, would make a difference. If you were an orthopedist and your state law said you could only work with two, and that was going to be limiting for you. If you were in dermatology or other specialties where there are multiple PAs who at that time worked with a single physician, it was going to be an issue for them. So it helped that PAs were doing the good work that they do, that helped open their minds to where we would go. And, you know, eventually now the Federation of State Medical Boards is a partner with AAPA on the PA Compact, as is NCCPA, which is great. And, you know, that, that wouldn't have happened many years ago. And I'm just delighted that it happened now. Some of it also has to do with the fact that we worked very closely with staff, trying to make the job easier for staff persons who worked with the Federation, which we could do because we were the experts in PA. So if they had a question, we knew the answer.
Yeah. Well, you know, here we are now, what, coming up on 60 years as a profession, and a lot of things have happened in the last couple of decades, and you've been around to see that as a seasoned professional. Let's talk a little bit about some of the, you know, the professional issues that are going on in the profession, in particular the, you know, optimal team practice. As you know, states like Utah, Oregon, even Arizona last year, and others have passed sort of modernization statutes addressing what we think are archaic rules and regulations. You know, what's been your thought about OTP, and are we going about the right way, and is it ever going to happen?
Oh, I think it's absolutely the right thing. You know, I say this for a lot of reasons. One is that the idea that you have to have, I think the most important idea is that the idea that you have to have a specific, I'm going to use the word relationship with an identified physician in order to practice as a PA is bad for patients. I'll tell you a personal story. You know, I had worked in Flagstaff Pediatrics where I did adolescent GYN. It was part of my supervising physician scope of practice, so I could do it because at that time you couldn't do anything that was outside of your supervising physician scope of practice. And then I moved to the little town where I live now and went to work with a solo physician, male, who did not do adolescent GYN. And so I could not do adolescent GYN. So all of these teenage girls who I had known for years, you know, are having a GYN issue, which I am fully capable of caring for. But because of the law, I could not. And that's crazy.
2 hours,
talk.
30 minutes
Sorry.
Completed.
That's crazy talk.
1,092
so,
calories.
That's a, you know, a real deal. And that was part of why we needed optimal team practice. The other thing is that, you know, PAs aren't going to abandon team practice. Certainly there are PAs who operate with a great deal of autonomy, and they should because they're experts in their field. But the idea that all of a sudden we're going to strike out and say, you know, we're not who we said we don't want teams anymore. We're interested in just, you know, not talking to anybody ever. It's not us. You know, we don't self-select that way. We aren't acculturated that way. We're not educated that way. So it's wrongheaded to think that you have to have, you know, a physician that puts the key in your back to make it so that you can work. So I'm a big proponent of optimal team practice. We tried to find, I'll just tell you that when we were working on the name, and when I say we, I mean a large group of people, including committees and the House of Delegates and the board of AAPA and other staff persons. When we were working on it, we tried to come up, was there a better name so we don't embark our marketing specialists and others. And we really decided that, well, optimal team practice was what we meant. You know, we weren't abandoning team practice. We just wanted it to work in a way that wouldn't diminish care for patients. So that's what we were looking for. You know, it also includes the ability for PAs to receive direct payment from the Medicare program and others, and then having autonomous separate PA regulatory agencies. Those are also key components of optimal team practice. And I think they're so important for PAs to be able to do what they need to, what they need to do and are able to do. So I'm bullish about optimal team practice. And I'm delighted that so many states are seeing it the same way. Again, it's logical, but that doesn't mean everyone's going to love it. And I'm unhappy, but not surprised by the AMA's response. You know, they, again, having gone to the AMA meeting, supporting our liaison OPA for many, many years, it's not a big surprise that they are not happy about this because, you know, they think if something happens in medicine that it needs to have their imprimatur on it, that they need to have approved it from the beginning. And it's tragic that their response is as it is, because if you really want to talk about what's good for access to care, what will allow people to provide for patients at their highest level, then you would want both physicians and PAs to have the flexibility and creativity to do that. So it's sad that they are responding the way they are. And I'm very happy with the way that the Academy is handling that, which is, association leadership to association leadership and stating the facts. I mean, does anybody think we have too many providers and they're well distributed in this country? That's not the case. So anything that allows people to work at in a way that's better for patients ought to be embraced and not something that people are fearful of or hesitant to support. And it's very hard, even with groups that will say that they are completely dependent on their PAs. They still will not come out and support this. The other part of my job that was really fun, and all of it was fun, but another part that was really fun was working with all of AAPA's constituent organizations. And, the department that I had the good fortune to lead both did state advocacy and interaction with all of the AAPA constituent organizations. There were 120, I think, when I left. So lots and lots of people involved in lots and lots of different organizations, and even groups that have very close relationships with the physician groups were, couldn't get them to see things the way that they needed to. I'm thinking particularly now of SEMPA with ASAP. So the SEMPA PAs, Society of Emergency Medicine PAs, were very integrated with the Academy of Emergency Medicine Physicians, but still, they couldn't get the doctors on a policy level to come to where they needed them to be, at least so far, unless something happened yesterday, to support support OTP. And that's an area, certainly emergency medicine, you have big shifts of people in large institutions, and saying that these two PAs have to be somehow assigned or connected with a designated physicians, it doesn't work, and it shouldn't have to. I'll say too that another thing that I was really fortunate to be able to look at over my career was the development of technology. For example, as ultrasound became so useful in clinical practice, we had a group of PAs in ultrasound who were true experts in their field and were able to help us develop, by us, I mean the Academy, the House of Delegates and others, to develop policy that supported things that would be good for patient care. And another example of it being just so fun to advocate for PAs because they were on the side of the patients, on the side of the angels. And it's fun to have that kind of group that you're supporting, staying up at night worrying about and find different places to talk to and all those things.
Yeah. Well, and I think you said this earlier, and I think it's right on target as we talk about OTP, and that is that we're in it for the long game. What I hear from many of my colleagues is, hey, the AAPA wants to do OTP and states want to do it. Why don't we just do it? And we are doing it, but people want to do it today and tomorrow. And particularly with the issue of a PA, centric regulatory board. What, there's only 5, 6, 7 states now that actually have that, Arizona being one of them, but that's a huge change in states to have that happen. So it just, I think it's having the patience and fortitude to do it, like you did for so many years. So Ann, let's throw on top of OTP, now that we're talking about that, we throw in the name change, the title, and the money that went into that, and the House of Delegates that passed it, and the Academy that's struggled with how to make that happen. Your thoughts?
Well, I'll just start by saying that we always had a terrible title. I mean, physician assistant was a terrible title from the get-go. It was awful. It was wrong. So something had to happen. I liked the idea of moving to PA, which I think initially might have come from PAs for Tomorrow, which was another fascinating thing. PAs for Tomorrow were groundbreaking thinkers at the cutting edge of where the academy should be, or where the profession should be going. And when it was suggested that they want to become a constituent organization, you know, I was delighted that they would want to come in-house, so to speak, and be part of the academy's leadership in that way. But not everybody was. And I can remember talking to several PAs who were saying, you know, you just can't. I mean, they can't be a constituent organization because they're just too different from the way we see things. And, you know, my position was different is good. You know, we need some different. Let's get some more of that. And of course, they have brought us a lot of ways to think about things that I think have been very good and important for the profession's growth. So I think the idea of calling the profession just PA as an interim step was great. And certainly I did that myself. You know, people will call you all kinds of different things when you are a PA. I can remember one pediatric patient used to refer to me as Dr. Mrs. Ann, which was, you know, a good combination. Certainly nothing that I ever used, but we've all had that case where people aren't quite sure what to call you. Now, I think this came from California, the idea of PA being what you called yourself. So I would be PA Davis, or, you know, that I think that was a good thing too. So I think physician associate is fine. I know there were some other contenders. I think we probably could have pulled off any of them, but it's just one of those things where it was wrong from the beginning and something had to be changed. I think that having PA stand for nothing, that's a little hard, you know? So I think we had to get to having a title that met with our initials, was aligned with our initials. So physician associate is fine by me, yeah.
This might be a good time to ask this. Melinda asked a question in the chat, you know, wondering what you think about the, you know, the issue going on. You may be aware of this in Arizona about the FMGs through Puerto Rico that found a loophole in the Arizona law. I was on the regulatory board when the governor created this. It was all because of COVID, created this loophole for FMGs to get a license. And now there are over 200 of them and people are going crazy about this. And what's your thoughts about that? Is there something, I mean, obviously ASAP is trying to work on that and to try to say that it's not the right thing, but your thoughts.
Are you talking about them being licensed as assistant physicians, that whole thing? No, they're being licensed as physicians.
They are no, they are licensed as PAs.
That's wrong. I'll tell you that the only time I remember grandstanding, and I'm embarrassed to tell this story, but I did it, there was a bill in California to license a bunch of international medical graduates as PAs. And one of the arguments they're making is that it was so important that the medical provider be able to speak to the patient in the same language that the patient spoke. And I couldn't stand it. So I got up and I gave my testimony in Spanish. and that was kind of the end of it. You know, I said, sí, es muy importante que las personas que trabajan con los pacientes también pueden hablar en el mismo idioma de los pacientes. And, you know, went on with what I was going to say. You know, that was kind of that. But you don't become one profession by being a failed another profession, right? I mean, we have criteria for becoming a PA. And I think if programs, and I wouldn't want to take this on, but if programs wanted to create a mechanism for, I'm not going to say fast tracking because it's not right, but having a cohort of international medical graduates who were evaluated and trained as PAs, I think that would be fine. I've worked with two PAs who had been physicians in one in Ecuador and one in the Philippines. And they were great PAs, but they, you know, they came here, they wanted to become PAs, they went to a PA school, they passed the PANTS exam, they got licensed in California. So I think that's the way that people need to see that is to use the door that's open.
Well, great. A couple more questions and I'm going to open it up. But, you know, another discussion going on in the profession, as you know, is around the entry-level doctoral degree in PA education. As you know, PAEA, a couple of years ago, said that their policy is that the master's degree should be the entry-level degree. And then last year at the summit, you know, reinforced that, saying we're going to stick with the master's level as the entry-level degree for the profession. Some people say, well, that's great, but it won't be long until the first PA program will be offering a doctoral as the entry level. What are your thoughts on that whole argument?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, I'll start by saying that I would never rain on anyone's educational aspirations. If somebody wants to get a doctorate degree, then of course they should. And if people want to, you know, you yourself got a PhD. I don't know how you, I don't know who you found Tanner, found down, Brandon. But, and I thought that was great. Part of our issue is that, you know, the people that we work most closely with, aside from other PAs, are called doctors. And so that's just thin ice, for good or for ill, it's thin ice. I remember that we had a big summit meeting, I'm sure you were there, I think in Atlanta, to discuss the doctorate for PAs as an entry-level degree. And we had people come to talk from physical therapy and from speech, hearing, and audiology kind of folks that talked about how they had moved to having a doctorate degree as the entry-level degree. And I'm going to tell you that at that time, there were not compelling arguments about why they should do it. I mean, they wanted somehow to have it, you know, be a prestige thing, or their grandmother always wanted them to be a doctor, or something else that was important that they thought they needed. But they didn't need that. And they didn't tell us anything that was good about why they were doing that. So I wasn't convinced. Now, am I convinced now? I'm not sure. I'm going to tell you that this is going to sound like an anathema to many of you who know me, but I don't have an opinion on that. You may think I'm lying, but it's really true. I will tell you that two things I worry about. One is the cost of education, because, you know, back when I went to PA school, again, my parents didn't have two nickels to rub together, and I made it because I went to community college. I lived in Colorado until I could get in-state tuition, and I went to a state school. And so I worry about the cost, and I also worry about keeping anyone out. So one of the good things about our profession has been the diversity, which is not adequate, that has changed since you and I were newly minted PAs. You know, back when I was first becoming a PA, it was me and a bunch of ex-former military guys. Pretty much that was it. And now, of course, the profession is predominantly female. We're not nearly where we need to be in terms of ethnic and cultural diversity, but I don't want us to, as a profession, to adopt any policy that would diminish our ability to achieve those goals. And that's where I would come down on that.
Great. So, let's take a second now, you know, based on your many experience as a PA and as an advocate and a legislator, you know, what advice would you give to our TMSA students and our alumni about the future of the PA profession?
I thought about this for quite a while, and I would say that my first bit of advice, which is always, you know, always hard coming from an old person, but I would say my first part of your advice is to preserve the brand. You know, we know where the profession came from. We became PAs because we are very interested in science and care, and interested in taking care of patients. And anything that diminishes that brand, I think, will be bad for us, because it has served us so well for so long. So any of you that, and I'm going to go out on a limb with my saw in my hand here, but any of you that call yourselves advanced practice clinicians, knock it off. Same thing with advanced practice providers, knock it off. If it's a group of PAs and advanced practice nurses, then it's PAs and advanced practice nurses. You got to say who you mean and not dilute the beauty of this fabulous profession. And that's not knocking advanced practice nurses. I mean, they are important contributors to the healthcare professions. And Some of them are very dear friends, but they're different than PAs are. So preserve the brand would be something that I would say early. And I think the other thing that I would remind people is that advocacy, even though it's hard, is everybody's job. We're not going anyplace unless we all work on this together. Even if all you could do, I mean, if you just had twins and you have a full-time job and your partner's in grad school, even if all you can do is to pay your dues to your state and national and specialty, if that's what you're interested in, or other PA organization, do that and support those who are able to do more in terms of advocacy, because nothing happens and no one will know more about how things should be regulated for PAs than we do. So we have to be involved in that, because left to somebody else's devices, they'll do it wrong. We're the experts. And so we need to be at the forefront of making sure that what happens is good for our profession and, more important, good for patients.
Yeah, well said. Well, I'm going to open it up for some questions, but I actually have the first one, and that is, you know, now that you're retired, Ann, what are you doing for fun?
Oh, so much. And again, you working people, I'm so sorry to have to tell you these things, but I'd say two big things. One is travel. Just got back from a month in Scandinavia and Ireland, part of it riding bikes. It was an electric bike, which I think still counts. And then I have a little van, which my son converted into a camper. But it's just, I mean, I could put a sticker on the side and deliver for Amazon. It looks like that kind of van. But I've been across the country, you know, at least once. And I love to go in it because I can park in somebody's driveway and see my friends. So I like to travel that way. And then I'm a very active volunteer, both formally and then, you know, I live in a neighborhood that has several older people. And so I'm checking on my neighbors all the time. But my big thing I do in volunteering is I volunteer for Habitat for Humanity. I don't build. I never should. No one would want me to build. But we have a very active habitat here. We have over 40 houses that have habitat families in them. And I chair what's called the Homeowner Support Committee. So after people become a habitat homeowner, we want them to be successful in habitat homeownership. So I work with others to support habitat homeowners in being successful. Just tomorrow, we're having a house of dedication, I think for our 44th house, which is very, very exciting. Single mom with three kids will be getting the keys very soon. So those are the things that I like to do. And that's, I'll say one more thing. And that is that after George Floyd was murdered, I was ill with grief and shame and worry, and decided that I needed to do something to address my own mental health. So I assembled a group of eight friends, and even though it was the middle of COVID, and we decided that we needed to educate ourselves about racism. So we read books and we see speakers and we go to art exhibits by African-American artists and support each other in our journey to understand our own racism and to help break it down where we can. So that's been my sort of intellectual pursuit. Not that grabbing my van isn't intellectual. It's quite challenging, but that's what I've been doing. And it's really fun.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. Well, let me open it up for any questions or comments that anybody has for Ann while we got a few minutes left.
Can I tell a story?
Of course.
So one of the things that Ann got me into that I often tell people about was when Ann invited me as president of the AAPA to join the president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners and the president of the American Academy of Family Physicians to talk to the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners meeting. Ann is a very good salesperson, and the fact that she talked me into that was pretty impressive. So the one line in my speech was, at that point, there was 36 million Americans without health insurance, and why are we fighting over turf? But that surprisingly did not carry the day. And as this the talk ended, about probably 25 nurse practitioners were making a beeline, tell me what they thought about my perspectives. And Anne said, "Bill, I need to get you out of here." So she did save my life from that perspective. Thank you very much.
I remember that you were very brave. I can't tell you what city it was, but I remember the room.
That's great. Other comments or questions?
Well, I'd kind of put all mine in the chat, but so when Anne was telling the stories, legislative stories, they just ring so true because we're still using a lot of that language, like the lumping of professions. And, we had to really be persistent with the Texas Medical Board to quit putting APP everywhere in the regulation. And I said it takes hardly any more letters to write PA and NP than it does to write APP. So why so lazy? And so we learned that we do have to be there every minute at every medical board meeting because they tried to pass a rule in radiology that we would have to be radiologists to do interventional radiology. We'd have to take a radiology course to do that. And so I just really thank you for teaching us to be so diligent and to listen to every word and to always be there.
You know, thank you for saying that. It's, I guess the other thing I would remind the future PAs is that, if you don't do it, it won't get done. And you can't rely on somebody else. And why should you? We're not carrying their water necessarily, and we cannot expect others to carry ours. So we have to be available and paying close attention and willing to do the work that it takes to make sure that things are going to be done for well for PAs. And I think that the litmus test that we should always use, if you can't make an argument about why this would be good for patients, stay home. No one wants to hear you if it's just about what's going to be good for you. And so it's important to frame your arguments and make sure you're telling the truth about who will be advantaged by what you are supporting, and then to make sure that you're there to do it, because you can't count on anybody else to do it. They won't understand it the way you do, and the outcome won't be what you want. I have to tell you about something about my job back when we had fax machines. You probably remember this. I was at work one morning, and even they let me telecommute most of the time. So I was at work at 6 in the morning because I worked East Coast hours and be at work when this staff was at work in DC. And I received a fax from the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. At that point, I did not know that that was United States territory and therefore my job. But I was up to my neck in a Mississippi thing, and I get this fax, a very lovely fax from the PAs and the CNMI saying, here's what we're up against. We really need the APA's help. And I thought, you can't, this can't be true. There can't be another one. It's like finding another puppy in a litter. It was just horrifying. But sure enough, there were PAs there, and they were willing to get to work on something. It was great to work with them. This was lots of fun. But the moment when I understood what this actually meant was a little bit much at the time.
Oh, that's funny. Thanks for all that you've done for the profession. And I miss those days of driving to Sedona and meeting and talking. And you may remember this at our 10th anniversary of ASAP in Tucson, and we were recognizing people, and unbeknownst to me, you got up and you had created a little star. It said Mr. ASAPA on it, and you gave it to me, and I still have it.
That's
So,
great. Good to
thanks for
know.
that, those days. Anybody else have any comments or questions?
I just want to say what a privilege it was that, and I use past tense because I'm no longer doing this, to have the job that I had and to get to work with so many talented and committed and sometimes obstreperous and difficult, but always interesting and intellectually stimulating people, both PAs and staff. When I left the APA, the staff that I was working with were just top notch, and it was a good group to work with. I'm still in touch with many, many of them. But it was a charmed career, and much of it because I got to work with people like you.
Well, thank you so much. All right. Well, I don't see any other questions or comments. Let me end this. But, you know, once again, Anne, thanks for your time this evening. And for the rest of you and those that watch this later, please place the date of September 30th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the next masterclass. Our guest next month will be John Burns, PAC. And you know, John has embodied the ideals of philanthropy and entrepreneurship throughout his life and career. And he's always worked in the surgical arena, cardiovascular surgery, and now is become the specialty director for Surgical Assistance of Florida. Anyway, his history in the profession is extensive as well, and as well as philanthropic work. And he's now doing work in Ukraine, and we'll be talking a lot about that. So please join us in September. And Anne, thank you so much, and for everybody joining us. And y'all have a good rest of the evening.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, guys.
Nice to see you again.
You too.